Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar, Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevahscrossing.com. Lecture 3, Thinking for Yourself in Religion. Independent Thinking.
The lecture for this morning is on the general subject of thinking for yourself in religion. Most of us, by the time we are college students, have developed a lot of uneasiness about accepting things just because we are told so. If we have some self-awareness, we know that we cannot totally divest ourselves of our childhood training, nor do most of us want to. And at the same time, we begin to think that we ought to understand why we are supposed to believe things, why they are true, on some more substantial ground than that our parents or the pastor says so, and perhaps even more substantial grounds than that the Bible says so, although that's really an answer of a different sort. Now, I want to raise the question this morning and try to answer it: how much independent thinking is a college student capable of anyway? I'm going to assume a student is capable of some, and then I'm going to talk about the techniques, if you please, or the ways by which we can learn to do valid independent thinking, specifically about matters of religion.
Do you have your own opinion?
But first, I want to ask you if you really do have your own opinions on very many subjects. I mean opinions that you have wrought out yourself, and are your own because you have drawn them on the basis of evidence that you have yourself collected. For example, what are your opinions about the Vietnam War that is currently raging? Have you done any independent thinking on this subject? Or have you adopted, on some thoughtfulness, but not very much first-hand investigation of the situation, or very much reading, have you adopted one of the two or three current opinions on Vietnam? Is it your own or not? Have you an independent opinion? Or have you taken over someone else's? After all, most of what we know has been told to us by someone else. Or what about your term papers, if you've written any? I guess we don't get to term papers until second semester in English composition. But even so, you've done writing of this sort in high school, and many of you already in college. Are your term papers really independent efforts? Let's suppose you're going to write a term paper on the causes of the Civil War. Will you present the professor with an independent judgment on this? Or is it not likely that you will work over a vast amount of secondary and tertiary material and then present to the professor the opinion to be shared by most scholars in the field? Now, you may have worked it all out yourself, but this can hardly qualify as an independent judgment on the causes of the Civil War. Or what about the great question of science? For example, what about the origin of the solar system, or the supposed evolutionary origin of human life? A number of you, if I called for an opinion on organic evolution, would have one. You would say, yes, a Christian can believe in evolution, or no, a Christian cannot believe in evolution. But I ask you, is that your own opinion, which you have arrived at by your own painstaking examination of the data? Or have you taken over someone else's idea because you liked it for one reason or another? I don't mean you haven't thought about it at all. I'm just asking you, is it really an independent judgment? You may begin to feel that I think there are limitations to the kind of independence we can attain as a college student. Where does this leave us, then, in the matter of religion?
Can we think for ourselves?
Can we think for ourselves in religion with any degree of independence? Well, I could say that you can think for yourself in religion, about to the same degree that you think for yourself in any other field. I could say that you can think for yourself in religion about the same as you can think for yourself in medicine. You can diagnose your own ailments, prescribe your own drugs, and appraise your own recovery. There are people who do this. I remember once I saw a man who had cut himself while he was opening a tin can. Cut himself on the thumb, he did, and it was rather a nasty gash. I saw him give himself a shot of procaine and suture up his own hand. Now you can do that, he did. You can diagnose your own ailments, prescribe your own remedies, appraise your own recoveries. Why not? You can do that if you're an MD. And there's nothing keeping you from becoming an MD if you want to. You can learn how to achieve independence of judgment and skill in that area, although you will have to submit yourself to a particular regimen of instruction and training in order to make that possible. There is nothing impossible about it at all, though there are certain steps you want to go through in doing this. You can think for yourself about Vietnam. You can go, as did Harrison Salisbury, who lived from 1908 to 1993 of the New York Times, to North Vietnam. You can observe. You can take notes. You can file dispatches. You can visit Saigon and all the military installations of the South. You can fly in a helicopter to observe battles and rescues. You can visit the hamlets and interview the nationals. If you gather up enough information and are an acute enough analyst, you may come up with a valid, independent opinion on Vietnam. It's not impossible. It can be done. Now, when I've discussed these two particular incidences, the matter of medicine and the matter of Vietnam, you see that thinking for yourselves depends directly on certain disciplines of observation, analysis, and training. And without those disciplines, your thinking really cannot be called independent. I want to discuss, therefore, three steps that are part of independent thinking. Some are true for any creative endeavor, and some are true particularly in the serious thinking about religion.
How to think for yourself in religion.
First, get the facts. Now, what we want is to find out for ourselves. We want to be sure of our position, not because someone told us so, but because we are acquainted with the situation and know. This means that we must begin by familiarizing ourselves with the facts. And unless we do, we can never know that our opinions are really grounded in reality. This is what's so hard about thinking about Vietnam. I wish I knew what I thought about it. And I'm sure I haven't read as much as some of you have read on it. Perhaps I've read more than some of you, but I'm not sure what to think about it. It is so complex, and it is so hard to be sure you are really in touch with the facts. And even if I should go there, how would I know, as George Romney thought, I wasn't being brainwashed by the military? How do you know this? They're the guys to tell you. They're the ones that tell you what the count of the dead is and what's going on in the hamlets about the infiltration. It's just awfully hard to be sure you really got the facts in this particular situation. And yet, until you have the facts, you can't really know that your opinions are grounded in reality. Well, fortunately, it isn't so complex in all areas of endeavor as seems to be the current situation in Vietnam. But my point is that until we acquaint ourselves with as many of the facts as we can get a hold of, we have no way of knowing that fancy and prejudice have not been dispelled. Only by getting a hold of the facts can we dispel wishful thinking and errors. Now, this is very, very clear in matters of science and history. How do you tell that a statement is true? By checking it with the facts. How can you know if there is gold to be found in Colorado? By going to Colorado and finding out for yourself. how can you form opinions on the origin of human life? You familiarize yourself with the facts and the alleged facts. You try to distinguish fact from theory, fact from interpretation. How can you work on the problems of the Civil War? Well, it depends. If you want to go into it in a fresh, creative way, you make a trek across the Deep South. You read small-town newspapers of 100 years ago. You investigate the journals of generals and soldiers and try to get all the primary data you possibly can. And then you put this together and try to come up with a synthesis, which rests on your own first-hand acquaintance with the facts. Now, class, in this connection, I think it's important for us to see that, for most of our knowledge about life, we are dependent on authorities, or people who claim to be authorities. And, as I said earlier, most of what we know, we've been told by others. We rely on others for most of what we know about world affairs today. For everything which happens today that you are not personally involved in, you must take someone's word for what's going on. If you couldn't depend on an authority, you would know nothing about the world situation today. Harrison Salisbury may have been to Vietnam, but most of you haven't. And anyway, he's not here today, and he doesn't know what's going on there today without taking the word of a lot of somebodies who are there. For something that happened before you were born, you are shut out to depending on authority. I doubt if there is a single person here who knows by direct first-hand contact that there was such a person as FDR. You would have to have seen him personally, not seeing him on TV, not hearing him on the radio. That doesn't count. How do you know it was FDR on the radio? How do you know that's FDR on the TV, who's long since gone? You see, that won't count. You've got to see him in person. Then you've got first-hand experience that there was such a person as FDR. Otherwise, it's an authority, and you depend on it for much of what's happened. It's true of science also. We do have lab courses, but it would be virtually impossible for you to duplicate the experiments of the ages, which have brought us to the present state of knowledge. You accept the roundness of the earth without ever having experiments to prove it. Boy, are we gullible. Who of you knows from experiment that the earth is round? You accept the movement of the solar system, the purity of the water you ingest. All of these things we take on authority. And so, when I talk about thinking for ourselves, it's clear that this does not mean abandoning authorities. The most of that we shall be able to do, in most areas of life, is to make a wise and judicious selection of authorities, for not every authority is an expert on what they claim. This is what I do in Vietnam. I have to pick out the men that I think know the most about it, and are giving the most objective reports. And I just kind of follow them blindly. They know more than I do. And I have to make as wise a selection of authorities as possible. Now I'm talking about getting the facts. And the point just is that we can't get the facts in most cases without taking somebody's word for it. Though there will be areas in which we do first-hand investigation of a lot of things. But it is astounding how many people have religious opinions without knowing anything about religion. A student once told me that, in his judgment, Jesus was an unattractive personality, weak, effeminate, and helpless. I was unkind enough to ask him if he had read the Gospels. He had not. I said, "Where did you get your information on Jesus?" "Oh," he responded, "our neighborhood theater showed a movie about him once." All right. If we're going to think for ourselves about religion, we must get the facts. Otherwise, our opinions will not be grounded in reality. Or if they are, it will be an accident. It happened in spite of ourselves. Get the facts. Second, except outside information. Now, when I've talked about getting the facts, this is something that can be applied to any area of study. We want to talk about religion. In class, when we talk about religion, we are really interested in knowing more than just, well, what did Jesus do? And what did Paul do? And Moses do? Of course, we're interested in such things. But the more important questions about religion don't really have to do with, where was Moses when the lights went out? The important questions about religion are not primarily factual. They have to do with questions of value. It's important for us to know, I guess, how human life arose. And there is an answer to this question, even though we may not have it. What's more important for us is to know whether life has any meaning. Science may be able to tell us how life arose. Science cannot tell us whether life has meaning or not. This is an old distinction, a distinction between questions of fact and questions of value. Let me illustrate just for a minute. The distance between Seattle and Moscow is a question of fact. There may be several different answers given to this, but it's only one distance. And if we can have accurate measuring equipment, we can find out the distance from Seattle to Moscow. It is a question of fact whether or not Richard Speck, who lived from 1941 to 1991, killed the student nurses. We may not know for sure, but either he did or he didn't. That's a question of fact. And as well as that question can be settled, it'll be settled on the basis of evidences which have been collected and gathered. Now, it is a question of value when I say, if Richard Speck killed the nurses, he should be executed. That's something else. That's not the kind of question you can answer by collecting facts. And people don't agree on that. But when you see that question, we have moved into a different area. We've left the realm of facts, where everything can be measured and an answer gotten if only you have the proper kind of instruments and are patient and clever enough. Instead, you've entered the realm of value, where you can't get answers just by collecting data. How do you know that a man should die if he's killed 8 people? I'm saying that most of our questions about religion are questions of value. Let me take some other examples. I want this to be clear. I can run an inductive study. Mr. Kinsey did this. Mr. Kinsey ran a survey to discover the sexual habits of the American male and the American female. This was a question of fact, at least presumably it was. And it turns out that American males do this, 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 and this. American females do this, 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 and this. These are questions of fact, all right? We put the question very differently when we ask, should a fellow and a girl have sexual relations before they're married? And you can't get an answer to that question by interviewing 1,001 people. You can find out what fellows and girls do by interviewing them, at least if they're telling the truth. But how do you find out what they should do, what they ought to be doing? That's entirely different. No number of interviews will help you settle that question, the difference between questions of fact and the questions of value. And so when we think for ourselves about religion, we have to move beyond questions of fact, which are accessible easily to us, and ask, how are we going to get information about right and wrong? And especially, as I'll say in my next lecture, how will we get information about God? Dealing with God, a special problem. Now, there's a special problem here. God, by definition, is a greater person than a human person. Don't get confused by the word person here. I'm using it very broadly. God, by any definition that really counts, is a greater person than a human person. We can find out what we want to know about other people, at least if they'll talk and tell us the truth, we can. But what do you do with a superperson? Now, I think you'll have to agree that God is a greater person than a human person. If he isn't greater than a human person, then he's unimportant to our thinking about religion. For example, it's claimed by religion that a man has responsibility to God. Well, I know how to cope with responsibility to other people. If I break the law and get caught, I take the rap. Now, if God is just another person on my own level, I know how to handle him already. It is only if he is a cosmic person, a deity, that the question of my responsibility to him becomes urgent. I can handle my responsibility to other people, but what am I going to do if I am responsible to a superperson? Or it is alleged by religion that God can give help in daily living. Now, I do need help in life. But if God is just another human being on my own level, I don't need him. I have enough friends as things now stand. I can call on them to help me. What I really need is help from beyond the human level. And I am only interested in God's help if he is more than a mortal. Now I'm trying to say that if God exists, we will have to understand him as a deity and not as a human person. Otherwise, he's of no interest to us at all. If God could be figured out by us, he wouldn't be worth having around. So what we need is information about a deity. How do we get this? Now, it will help us if we know how to get information about persons on our own level. How can I find out about the character, the wishes, and the reactions of other people? What can I tell about you if you never talk? Well, I can tell a little by seeing what you do and how you react to people in situations. But I would learn relatively little by observation only. Suppose that in the second place you would consent to answer my questions. In that case, I could learn a great deal more about you, provided you told me the truth. You could always be evasive or deceptive, and I might not know the right questions to ask, and you could effectively keep me from knowing what you are really like. You must open yourself to me. You must tell me the truth about yourself. No amount of observation or prying will let me get at the real you. The real you must be given to me by yourself. Now this is, in a way, a kind of revelation of yourself, an opening, a disclosure, a making bare. And you do this, at least with your best friends. There are people who know the real me and the real you, but they found that out because we let them know, because we open ourselves to them. Now, it is true that knowledge of another person depends on voluntary self-disclosure. How much more is it likely to be so with the knowledge of God? If one person cannot really plumb the personality of another person without revelation of that person, how could you dope out God? My point is, if you could, he wouldn't be God. He'd be just another person. And so this brings us to a peculiar question in our thinking about religion. There is information that we cannot get by the best gathering devices that we have. Who will photograph God? Who will put him on tape? How will Life magazine run an interview? How do you find out what God is like? Well, you will find out if and only if God lets you know. That's all. If somehow he lets you know what he is like, then you will have some of the information about him that you need to answer the questions of value which are pressing. And this is what I mean by outside information. It's one thing to say, I've got to depend on some authority for my knowledge of Vietnam. It's another thing to say, there are some facts that I can't get at all and have got to be given to me voluntarily and graciously by God himself. It's not just that I have to take some authority about what God is like. is that if he doesn't open and let me know, I will never find out at all. Now, right now, I'm not talking about how this information about God is available, if it is available. I'm just pointing out that when you're talking about God, you put yourself in a situation different from that of science. In talking about God, mere cleverness and patience, mere observation and analysis will not suffice. We must be given information that is not otherwise available to us. Only this will enable us to answer the question of value and meaning which plague our thinking. Poet W. H. Auden, who lived from 1907 to 1973, has put it this way. We who must die demand a miracle. How could the eternal do a temporal act? The infinite becomes a finite fact. Nothing can save us that is possible. We who must die demand a miracle. Is that a paradox? Nothing can save us that is possible. Nothing can save us that is possible. We who must die demand a miracle. How do you say what I've been saying? We can't get it on our own. It's impossible. And yet we have to have it, or we can't answer our most pressing questions. So here it is, class. Accept outside information. Thinking about religion is different from thinking about any other subject. We will have to have some revelation, God's voluntary self-disclosure, or we can do no thinking at all. Finally, in the third place, think. That's all. Think. Now, that may seem tautologous to say, which means an argument that repeats an assertion using different phrasing, but it's not enough to have gathered facts. It is not enough even to have gathered information about God, information which has come from beyond our own investigative capacities. You must do something with the facts. Selectivity must be employed. Some facts are important. Some are not. You must know which are which. Perspective is required. A certain breadth which enables you to see an isolated fact as important, because it is part of a much larger issue. Let me talk about this perspective for a minute. Take a matter of current affairs. When the Arab-Israeli crisis was on during the past summer, one news commentator noted how angry Russia was at Israel's action. In fact, we all noted this, but what's the significance of that particular fact? Why was Russia so angry? Well, one commentator suggested, he may not be right, but it illustrates what I mean by perspective, besides being an interesting idea on its own. One commentator suggested that perhaps Russia's anger at Israel's action was partly because Israel had acted as a great power, acting unilaterally in its own interest, letting the chips fall and holding its gains. Now see, that's not the way a little power acts. That's the way a great world power acts. And perhaps Russia was angry because a little power had suddenly begun to act like a great power. And there is also Russia's embarrassment at having poured arms and finances into Arab countries and having to see the Arabs suffer a severe military defeat. This was at the hand of Israel after the Six-Day War fought between June 5 and 10 in 1967. Now, the commentator that says these things has got to have a certain background knowledge, a certain ability to rise above the present situation, and to see it in a much broader light. This is perspective. It's not just the facts that you've got. It's what you do with them. It's how you tell which are important and which aren't, and how to put the facts together to make valid conclusions. This is what really counts. So when you think for yourself in religion, you must really wrestle with the facts and with their significance. Now, this is not done very often. Several years ago, I knew a fellow when I was in the East, a high school senior of considerable ability. He graduated from high school the year I left the East, and I did not see him during the year that followed. I was back in the East during the summer, and I ran into this guy out in the shopping plaza somewhere. We edged into a sandwich shop and sat down because I wanted to talk to him. Well, during that year, he had gone to a state college in his hometown, but quit because he saw he was going to flunk, and he spent the rest of the year, that was before the draft, he spent the rest of the year sacking hamburgers at a McDonald's stand and working part-time in a ski shop downtown. "I've been doing a lot of thinking," he told me, "and I decided the time had come that I wanted to think for myself and stop taking the opinions of my parents and my church. I decided that all I believed, I'd been told to believe." Well, I was a little embarrassed by this. I was embarrassed because I was basically in favor of doing this kind of independent thinking on your own. So what do I say to a guy who says, "I've been doing this and I've come to a different place. I've had to give up a lot of the traditional beliefs." I don't know what to say, really. I hemmed and hawed, and finally I said, "Well, Richie, when you begin to think for yourself, what did you decide about Jesus Christ?" To my amazement, he blushed. He stammered. It only took an instant before he recovered himself, but I detected immediately the true situation. He finally got something out, but the case was clear. He had not thought at all.
Think hard about the things that matter most.
Now, giving up what you've been taught is not the same as thinking for yourself. When you think for yourself, you may give up what you've been taught. I can't control this. But don't think that you are engaging in independent thinking if you just abandon what you've been taught. These are not the same thing. And my young friend, I'm sure, had not done any real thinking. He had merely given up. And that's why I say the third point here is think hard about the things that matter most. After you have collected the facts and been willing to accept some outside information about God, you still have the hard work of thinking about these things. You've struggled with this on the paper about the presuppositions of your life. Quite a few of you have come to me and talked with me about it. And I see that it's been hard for you to think about these things, partly because you aren't used to doing this kind of thinking, but partly for other reasons. And some of you have made this clear. It's painful to think about yourself very deeply. You don't always like what you find. Sometimes illusions about yourself are more comforting and pleasant than the truth. Sometimes illusions about ourselves are more comforting and pleasant than the truth about ourself. But we want to be mature persons. We want to be persons who do know ourselves as we are, without illusion. We want to be persons who can face ourselves and can face life as it really is. And therefore, I say, by all means, make this a semester of independent thinking about religion. But let your thinking be governed and guided by the conditions under which alone your thinking will have validity. And by all means, when it comes right down to the hard work of actually weighing opinions, contrasting them, evaluating them, trying to discover the stronger, don't chicken out because it's gotten hard. Hold steady, and light will come at the end of that hard struggle. Now, this assumption that you can do some kind of thinking for yourself about religion is going to run through the whole semester's work. In one way or another, I'll be calling on you at different times to formulate your own opinions and to give the grounds for those opinions. I haven't decided just what the paper topics will be for the semester, but for example, I sometimes have asked students to write just a little paper on what is a Christian. And when I read that paper, I want to know how you know that's what a Christian is. Everybody and his brother has got religious opinions. What I want to know is, do you have any evidence to back your opinions up? So that makes the semester an interesting challenge for you. I think all of us really have questions about religion, for which we want answers. Let's have eyes open and ears open, and minds open to the ways by which we can best come to conclusions on these questions. And that's all for this morning.
Thank you for listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.